chapelboro.com. Go there quick and stay a while. chapelboro.com. More of what you live here for. And now, welcome to Who's Talking with D.G. Martin on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Well, Beethoven's Ninth. That symphony is the work most often used to solemnize. On great occasions. It's the part of it's the anthem of the European community. It's used at the signing of peace treaty, the opening of the United Nations. What is it about the ninth that is so wonderful? And I have the privilege of asking the author of a book called The Ninth, Beethoven and the World in 1824, Harvey Sachs. Welcome to Who's Talking.
Thank you very much.
Well, it's a treat for us in Chapel Hill to hear your in-depth study and reminiscing and your music critics and historians' approach to Beethoven's Ninth. What got you started thinking about this wonderful Beethoven's last work?
Well, first of all,
Beethoven's Last Symphony.
Last Symphony, yeah. First of all, reminiscing, I don't know, because even though I'm getting kind of old, I wasn't actually there in 1824. But although after having spent years working on and off on this book, I sometimes feel as if I...
That you really were there. What do you take us there in your book. You take us into Vienna and walk us down the streets from Beethoven's apartment to the location of the concert hall where the premiere of Beethoven's Ninth took place in 1824.
Right.
Like a tour guide.
The theater doesn't actually exist anymore, but, you know, I sort of walked to the spot so that I would know about how long it would have taken him, assuming that the bridges that are there now across the Danube Canal were there at the time as well, which I'm actually not so sure about. Mm. But
might have had to take a longer detour around the canal.
Might have had to, or he might have gone by carriage. We don't know that for sure. But he was a great walker, so it's like New Yorkers today. You know, it's easier to get around walking than taking public transportation. Anyway... what got me on that? Well, I've loved Beethoven's music since I was 11 or 12 years old, and he's always been a sort of vivid, living presence in my life, my musical life. But, you know, also I think some of his attitudes, certainly not all of them, have influenced me in my daily life as well. But in any case, the actual cause of writing this book was when a friend said to me after I was in the process of finishing my previous book, why don't you choose a year in musical history that was important for one reason or another and write about that year, making that particular work the centerpiece, but also talking about other things that were going on in the world at the same time. So that's how the actual project got started. And, you know, I picked 1824. I had thought about some other important years in musical history as well, but I settled on that one.
Well, I'm not sure where to go because I'm very curious about history, but let's go to the actual year 1824 in a little bit, but let's go to and what else was happening. But have you take us, if you can, put us in Beethoven's shoes and tell us about his apartment and what he was up to in 1824. Where was this in terms of his career? How was his deafness doing? And then what were the economics of the premiere concert? How did all that take us for a walk through Vienna in Beethoven's shoes?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, Beethoven was not a native Viennese. He was born in Bonn in what is now Germany. Of course, then Germany as a nation did not exist. There were various principalities and duchies and so on. And Beethoven, Bonn was one of the Catholic cities and sort of city-states of Germany. Much of Germany was Protestant, of course, but Bonn was Catholic, and it had a direct relationship with Vienna. And so when Beethoven got to an age at which he wanted to study with more important musicians than the ones he had been able to study with in his native town, which was rather provincial, he went to Vienna. He went there for the first time when he was 16, going on 17, to study with Mozart, in the hopes of studying with Mozart. But practically as soon as he got there, he was called back to Bonn because his mother was very ill and, in fact, died shortly after he got back. And he had to take charge of his younger brother's upbringing because their father was a drunkard and irresponsible.
Well, this has got me quite interested. This moment, or this very short time that Beethoven was a student or prospective student of Mozart's.
Mm-hmm.
What happened? I mean, what happened? How did they get along? And
well, we don't know whether they in fact actually met. All we know, scholars are fairly certain that Beethoven at least heard Mozart perform at some point. There is a story that's been bandied about for two centuries and more to the effect that Beethoven actually went to Mozart to play for him and, you know, to ask to be taken on as a student, and Mozart was rather distracted at first, hearing Beethoven play, I think, one of Mozart's own pieces, according to this story. But then Mozart gave him a theme and said, improvise on it, and Beethoven was a fantastic improviser. And the story, the legend is that Mozart then, you know, became very interested and said, someday this young man will make a noise in the world, or something to that effect. But that is really...
You're skeptical. You're skeptical about this.
Well, we really have nothing to confirm or not confirm that story.
Well, it puts it in perspective for those of us who are not, you know, who love music but are not students, that that although we have this image of Mozart as being this young scoundrel and Beethoven as being sort of an old, stern sort of person, mm-hmm. that actually, age-wise, Mozart was a little bit older than...
That's right. Mozart was about 14 years older than Beethoven. And so when Beethoven went to Vienna in 1787 for the first time, Beethoven was born in mid-December. So even though he was born in 1770, when he went in 1787, he was only 16, not 17. And Mozart was at that point 31, an old man of 31, who had only four more years to live. And in fact, when Beethoven then went back to Vienna after his brothers were old enough to look after themselves, he went back in 1792 when he was 21. By then, Mozart had been dead for several months, and the Count Waldstein, who gave Beethoven the money to go to Vienna and study, sent a note along saying, may the spirit of Mozart be transmitted to you through the hands of Haydn, because the intention was that Beethoven would study then with Joseph Haydn, the other most famous composer of the day after Mozart, although he was older than Mozart. And so Beethoven did indeed study with Haydn. Haydn, like many great masters in their field, was not a particularly good teacher. And so Beethoven studied partly on the sly and partly openly with other teachers mm-hmm. as well. And, of course, he was already an accomplished musician when he got to Vienna at the age of 21, but he needed to perfect his
studies. Those of us who know Mozart only through the play and the movie might be interested that one of Beethoven's teachers was Mozart's rival, Salieri.
Salieri taught many important musicians. He also later taught Schubert. Salieri was a very, very fine musician. He simply wasn't as original a creative artist.
He might have been a better teacher than Mozart, who was in the sense that because he was not quite as gifted, he had to work a little bit harder on the fundamentals, I guess, to be.
Yeah, or, you know, there are people who simply have a gift for teaching and others who don't.
We need to take a break, and I've gotten you way off topic. I was going to get you to walk us down the streets of Vienna, and then I got you on another topic. But let's take a quick break. I'm visiting with Harvey Sachs, who's the author of The Ninth, Beethoven and the World in 1824. He and I will be right back.
Chapelboro.com. Go there quick and stay a while. Chapelboro.com. More of what you live here for. And now back to Who's Talking with D.G. Martin on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Harvey Sachs. He's the author of a newly published in paperback book, The Ninth. It's a subtitled Beethoven and the World in 1824. And Harvey Sachs has agreed to take us to Vienna in 1824 for the first performance of Beethoven's Ninth. We won't have the music, but we'll have the background and how Beethoven how he happened to be walking down the street towards the concert hall on May 7th, 1824.
Yes. Well, as I mentioned, Beethoven had, you know, moved to Vienna as a young man, and he lived there the rest of his life. Now, Beethoven, you had asked before about his way of living in Vienna. Beethoven was notoriously disorganized, and his increasing deafness over the years made him rather difficult to get along with. He was suspicious that people were cheating him. And he lived in many, many different apartments in Vienna over that long period of his existence there. So in 1824, when he completed the Ninth Symphony, which was, we think, around late February, something like that, he was living in a street called the, I believe it was called the Landstrasse, now called Ungargasse, and he was living on the top floor of a four-story building that still exists. Of course, in those days, to live on the top floor was the cheapest way because there were no elevators.
Right.
Climb to the top. In any case, there are descriptions from about that period of his apartment with, you know, in complete disarray, with piles of music papers strewn here and there, with even an unemptied chamber pot under the grand piano.
It didn't smell too good in there.
I'm sure it didn't, but probably most places didn't for indoor plumbing.
He was well known and maybe the leading composer of the
times.
And so he was wealthy, was he? Or
he was not wealthy, no, but he was not indigent either. Mm. I mean, he had enough to live on. He was always constantly worried about finances and trying to raise more money, not only for himself, but to leave for his nephew, his late brother's son, whom he had adopted very ill-advisedly. And he was constantly trying to make enough money to be able to live with some kind of security.
Were there prospects to make, I mean, how did a composer make money? There are no recordings, no CDs, no way to sell it. Was there a possibility that he could make money on this premiere of his this much-awaited Ninth Symphony?
Well, that was his goal. Of course, most composers in those days made most of their money by actually performing their own works. But by the time Beethoven wrote the Ninth Symphony, when he was in his early 50s, he was almost totally deaf, and therefore he could no longer play the piano. Even though he had been a great master of the keyboard, he could no longer play in public. He couldn't hear what he was doing. So the rise of Beethoven coincides with the rise of the music publishing industry. You know, with the Industrial Revolution, you get a growing middle class, people buying pianos for the home. That became the piano became the home entertainment system of the early 19th century, actually throughout the 19th century. And so there was more and more an appetite for buying printed music that people could play in their homes. Before that, music publishing had been a sort of an adjunct, in a way, something that composers like to have because, you know, it gave their music a certain degree of permanence, but it was only in the early 19th century, in Beethoven's day, that publishing music became a major source of income.
Well, but not, you couldn't take the Ninth Symphony and publish it and have it performed in the home, I guess.
No, but they would do piano reduction. They would have either the composer himself or an assistant or somebody would make an arrangement for piano, and then they would make other arrangements of symphonic works, you know, for string quartet, for violin and piano, you know, different arrangements so that people could hear this music in their own homes, even though they weren't hearing it, you know, in the original version. So Beethoven, in 1824, he was 53, going on 54. He was kind of a mess, personally, unkempt, although he's very clean in his personal habits. But he was not known as...
Was he attractive? Did women like him? Was he?
Yeah, actually, he had a number of affairs, and there was, for a long time, until he reached his probably early to mid-40s, he had the goal of getting married and having a family. Of course, you know, the mind boggles at the idea, given his eccentricity and his touchiness and pride and so on. I mean, the marriage would probably have been a complete disaster, but in any case, it never happened. And he died a bachelor. But he loved women and was very attracted to them. And many, even though he was not a handsome guy, there were plenty of women, including upper-class women, who were attracted to him, probably by the force of his personality and genius.
No, I was just going to say briefly, tell us about this opening night and came and...
Right. This was on May 7th, not 1824. Beethoven had prepared the symphony, had prepared for this concert. He himself invested the money to pay for the orchestra. You know, there were no permanent symphony orchestras in those days. The theaters had their own orchestras. And he paid to have the theater orchestra augmented by other players because it needed to be much larger for this symphony. The symphony, of course, requires four vocal soloists and a four-part choir. So he had to put up the money for the theater rental and so on. And he wanted, because this was his first and only concert in many years in Vienna, he wanted to raise the ticket prices so that he could actually make something back on his investment. But the local authorities didn't allow that for reasons unknown.
It was like rent control in New York, sort of. I mean, we're going to have to take, I hate to interrupt you in this. Uh-huh. If you can hold on to that thought, we'll come right back to it after a short break. I'm visiting with Harvey Sachs, the author of The Ninth, Beethoven and the World in 1824. And I'll be right back.
Chapelboro.com. Go there quick and stay a while. Chapelboro.com. More of what you live here for. And now back to Who's Talking with D.G. Martin on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Harvey Sachs, the author of the newly published in paperback, The Ninth, Beethoven and the World in 1824. And we're talking about this first this premiere of Beethoven's last symphony, one that had been much anticipated, and yet Beethoven not only had to compose this symphony, as you were describing, Harvey Sachs, he was the producer. He had to put it all together he had to hire the people to do this and, I guess, sort of rent the hall and negotiate authorities about what price he could charge. And how did it all work out?
Well, it was not a failure. I mean, as far as the symphony, the performance itself was concerned, it was a success. Beethoven was greatly applauded. The work was applauded, although we know that it cannot have been performed very well. The parts, the orchestra parts and choral parts were still in manuscript, so they were hard to read. The music itself was completely unprecedented in its difficulty, and much of it must have sounded very strange to the ears of the public of the day. But Beethoven was, an authority and a very important figure in Viennese cultural life, and indeed in the whole German-speaking world and beyond, England and even in France and so on. They respected him tremendously. So it was a major event, and we know from contemporary accounts that at one point, we don't know whether it was after the second movement or at the very end of the symphony, the applause was tremendous, and Beethoven, of course, didn't hear it. He was facing the orchestra, and Carolina Unger, the contralto soloist, tugged at his sleeve and turned him around so that he could see that the public was applauding and cheering him. And it's very touching to think about, somebody who had written this tremendous musical masterpiece and could not hear it. But in any case, as far as the financial side was concerned, he made a little bit of money on it, but he had hoped to make enough to create some kind of security for himself and his nephew, and that did not happen. He earned enough probably to pay a couple months' rent, and that was it.
Well, and no more residuals from this that he was being...
No, that didn't exist.
There's so many more things I'd love to talk about just on this one day on May 7th that seems to be the sort of the... I guess, the keynote of your book. But you also talk about 1824 and about Beethoven's Ninth as sort of important in historical times as a bridge between classicism and romanticism, as a transition, as a complicated transition point in history from the reaction to the French Revolution and Napoleon to the reestablishment of absolutism, but the yearning of the artist for more freedom and for and more openness. So it's politics and music and the all in a cacophony of voices for people who are trapped in in different either classical romantic periods or just in their own different worlds. What was it about 1824 that made it important in history, and how did Beethoven's Ninth fit into all of that?
Well, of course, one could pick almost any year in history and make a case for it as an important year. I picked 1824 because of the Ninth Symphony. But what interested me particularly about that is that this was a period of tremendous political repression after the end of the French Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars. There was the restoration of monarchy and absolutism in Europe. And
let me interrupt you just for, and I really do apologize for this, but I'm trying to get a current analogy, and it doesn't really pop up at me. But we've watched Russia go through a liberating revolution from the absolutism of the communist regime, and then have a flowering of democracy, and then the comeback of repression in terms of a pretty stable authoritarian state again. And is that sort of what happened after the French Revolution and the Napoleonic Wars, that the old order came back in and
I mean, the Russian situation is, of course, extremely complicated.
Of course,
and,
yeah.
And, the fact that there is worldwide communication now means that
tougher to repress.
You can't stop ideas flowing in no matter how hard you try. But the fact is that, yes, at the end of that revolutionary period, with the defeat finally of Napoleon and the monarchies returning and trying desperately to shore up their, the concept of divine right and so on and so forth. And so here in Vienna in 1824 with Metternich, the emperor's prime minister, perfecting in a sense the first modern police state, you have Beethoven writing the first symphony that has words in it, and the words are a sort of paean of praise to brotherhood, universal brotherhood and freedom and love and joy and all of these things that Metternich was out to eliminate. And as I say in my book, if Beethoven had not been considered, sort of beyond and untouchable in a way, and so eccentric that his ideas couldn't actually be taken seriously, he probably would have been jailed.
Oh, really? This is heresy. He was. This was something the censors for anybody else would have struck down. These words.
Yeah, I mean, he doesn't actually come out and say, revolt against what's happening in our countries. But he's saying, in effect, we have to go beyond this. We have to think about the universality of human ideals and aim for that and for joy in our lives and so on and so forth. And so, this goes against what was actually happening. On the other hand, it doesn't actually, as I say, the poem that Beethoven used was a poem that had been written, about 30 years earlier by Schiller, the Ode to Joy. And so it was already a classic poem. Beethoven used certain parts of it and rearranged those parts to fit his own needs. And he also added his own words at the very beginning. The first words that were ever sung in any symphony, Beethoven has the bass soloist say, "Oh, friends, no more these tones." He's talking about the music that had gone before, which was sort of cataclysmic. And he says, let's sing something more pleasant at this point.
Oh, that's what that means. Okay,
right.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. And then it goes on from there to make use of Schiller's.
But nevertheless, this universal brotherhood theme that at least we read into this, into Schiller's words and the music, this because it was French Revolution talk in some respects.
That's right. It was. It was written during the French Revolution, or in the immediate aftermath of the French Revolution, and the text goes against the grain as far as what was happening in Europe after the defeat of Napoleon. And of course, the French Revolution was defeated in a sense temporarily, and not entirely, because in France, for instance, when Louis XVIII returned to power after the defeat of Napoleon, they did start to allow a certain number of freedoms, because they realized that if they were too repressive, the whole process would start all over again. So the German-speaking countries actually were more repressive than France itself after that beginning of the Restoration.
We're visiting with Harvey Sachs, who's the author of The Ninth, Beethoven and the World in 1824. He and I will be right back.
Chapelboro.com. Go there quick and stay a while. Chapelboro.com. More of what you live here for. And now back to Who's Talking with D.G. Martin on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Harvey Sachs. He's the author of a newly published in paperback, a book called The Ninth, Beethoven and the World in 1824. And Harvey Sachs, it was such fun to talk to you about this, because I don't know anybody who knows more about Beethoven than you seem to know. One part of your book is sort of on the influence of Beethoven or the influence of the times on Beethoven's contemporaries and those who followed him. And as I mentioned to you earlier, I'm not really a student of music, but when I listened to Beethoven's Ninth again, particularly the first movement, I thought, heck, that sounds like Wagner. that's just a confessional. But yeah. then I was comforted when I read in your book how complicated and profound the influence of Beethoven on, Wagner seemed to be haunted by Beethoven. How did all that work?
Well, there are sort of, I would say, three great revolutionaries in music history. Music evolved, of course, in a natural way, but there are three composers who really turned things around, voluntarily or involuntarily. And the first of them was Beethoven. Beethoven, because he said, the rules do not permit it, but I permit it, he wrote music that sort of diverted the riverbed of music history in a way. And the next composer to do such a thing was, in fact, Wagner. And, we can love or not love Wagner's music, but this is an incontrovertible fact that Wagner, again, pushed the boundaries of the harmonic boundaries of music and in certain areas, the expressive boundaries of music beyond where they had been going before. So, again, the riverbed was re-diverted. And the third one, in my opinion, several decades later, was Stravinsky. Mm. But to go back to Beethoven and Wagner and other composers of the day, Beethoven's musical language, especially in his later works, meaning the works of late 18-teens and the 1820s up to his death in 1827, those works were, in a sense, transcendent. They were the works of this deaf man who heard the music internally and no longer cared. I mean, of course, he wanted his music to be performed and loved, but he was writing music. He had, I think I put it this way in the book, he had his big guns aimed at the future at that point. And this was something new in music history. The composers up to his immediate predecessors, Mozart and Haydn, they all knew that musical styles changed and that Bach music was no longer performed very much, if at all, except by students. And so they assumed that their music, too, would be performed for a while after their deaths and then go out of fashion, and that would be the end of that. With Beethoven, Beethoven believed very strongly that he was writing for future generations. And he gave his music a sort of moral force, or he himself attached a moral force to music in general and to his music in particular. So this whole concept, this romantic concept of the composer's and the artist's place in human society and human history very much influenced many of the people who followed him. First and foremost, Wagner.
What was the impact of Beethoven's music, or his, or who he was, or the fame that he achieved? How did that impact Wagner? I mean, you read Wagner and his wife's diaries, and you got into Wagner's head, I think.
Which is not a particularly pleasant place to be, I must say. Wagner was an incredibly selfish, egomaniacal person, racist, and, he was pan-Germanic and everything. I mean, he ended up being, you know, sort of against everything that was not Germanic culture. But so he was influenced, unfortunately, not by Beethoven's concept of worldwide
not his brotherhood.
But he was influenced by his music. And the Ninth Symphony in particular was a work that that Wagner sort of absorbed. He himself, Wagner, was a fine conductor. He conducted the Ninth Symphony on a number of occasions, important occasions. And he saw, of course, Wagner saw everything that had gone before him as leading up to him. And so the Ninth Symphony he saw as, Beethoven could no longer contain himself with pure instrumental music. He couldn't express enough. He had to burst into song in the last movement of the symphony. And so Wagner saw that as the lead-in to his own concept of music drama and the force of words combined with music, and, of course, adding theater as well. So that's essentially... Wagner goes back and forth in the diaries of sort of saying, Beethoven, he wasn't quite up to my standard, but, he was awfully damn good for his day. On the other hand, saying, I've never written anything as great as this particular passage in the Ninth Symphony.
Yeah.
So he did, in moments of introspection, he did understand that, it's not a question of better than or worse than. It's a question of accomplishing what you set out to accomplish and doing it in a way that is absolutely masterly.
We just got a minute or two left, and so many things I'd like for you to talk to us about. But one of your important points was placing Beethoven as a bridge or as a, in some point in terms of this movement towards Romanticism, and was Beethoven a Romanticist?
Well, we tend to pigeonhole things because it makes the history easier for historians. There was, for the writer E.T.A. Hoffmann, for instance, Haydn and Mozart were already, he considered them romantic composers because they were putting a personal expression into their music that, for him, constituted romanticism. But, of course, personal expression in music existed in Bach and before. So, what we consider romanticism is sort of a more free-flowing, the ability to break with traditional forms. And Beethoven, in a sense, is the instigator of that in in the history of music. And Beethoven tremendously in this idea of expressing one's inmost soul and making that a part of one's work, this tremendously influenced almost all the composers who came after him, and some did it with great success and others less so, but it became a sort of sine qua non of artistic expression at that point.
Well, Beethoven did compose some great music after the Ninth, but it was his last symphony. And so before we stop talking, Harvey Sachs, you've completed the Ninth Symphony, at least your book, The Ninth Symphony, and now have it out in paperback. But you must be working on it. What do you aspire to do next?
Well, my main project, now my very first book, which is now well over 30 years old, was a biography of Arturo Toscanini, the conductor. Mm. And so much new material has emerged since that book came out that I am doing a new biography of Toscanini. I'm working on that now hope to have it out within the next 2 or so years.
Well, I hope that you'll give us the privilege of visiting with you again when that book is ready.
That would be great.
Thanks again to Harvey Sachs for sharing a discussion of Beethoven in the context of his book, The Ninth, Beethoven and the World in 1824. And thanks to all y'all for listening. It's been Who's Talking. I'll be back here before you know it.